Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. What we've been practicing in the meditation is mindfulness of the breath and mindfulness of the mood of the mind. And tonight I'd like to talk a little bit more about mindfulness and the role that it plays in our cultivation of the path and how we use mindfulness for that cultivation. Because mindfulness, although we hear about it and we find it in many of the teachings that the Buddha has given, the precise teachings, the gradual training of the mind. Many of those teachings include mindfulness as an important part of a group of practices or qualities that we have to develop. But I think we often don't realize that mindfulness is a means to an end, and we need to use it to start to uncover the deeper levels of truth or reality that the Buddha's teaching is encouraging us to see. And in one of the sets or groups of teachings which the Buddha gave, called the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, mindfulness is mentioned as the first factor. And in this group of seven factors or qualities proceeds to investigation of Dharma and the cultivation of energy so that we can develop the mind in meditation. And for many of you, you will have come here wanting to develop the mind in meditation and to get the results of that, the fruits of that. And so mindfulness is important because it's an integral part of the path of practice. But I'm just using this set of seven factors to show how mindfulness on its own won't accomplish the task. It has to be developed in conjunction and leading on to the development of these other qualities. So mindfulness, many of you will have heard many times the definition that has two aspects to it. There is the aspect of paying attention. The sati is the Pali word, and then understanding or clearly comprehending what it is that we're paying attention to. This is the sampajanya is the Pali word for this. And paying attention or bare attention is to maintain the focus of our awareness on the object that we take up. And in this particular practice that we've been doing, we first of all made the object of our awareness the whole body, the sitting posture and how it felt. And then we moved through the body to particular parts of the body and to the feeling in that particular part. We weren't so interested in the shape or the size, but the feeling in that part of the body. So we're narrowing down the focus of our awareness to the feeling in that part. And then the whole body. Again, the feeling of the whole body sitting. And then we narrowed our awareness down to the mood of the mind. Not the body, but the mind. What does it feel like? So at this particular time, when we think about the mood, when we feel it directly, we might just say, well, it's pleasant or unpleasant, or it's tired or busy or whatever, a general mood. And then we paid attention to the breath, narrowing down the focus of our awareness on the body to just one thing, the flow of the breath. But again, the feeling of the breath, because that's how we know it directly, through the feeling that arises, the physical sensation that arises when the air that we're breathing in makes contact with the body, wherever that is, at the lips, above the lips, at the base of the nose, the nostrils, wherever it is that we feel the breath, we know that we're breathing in and out. And so paying attention to the breathing is simply knowing that touch of the breath, focusing our attention on that object. But the clear comprehension knows whether we're breathing in or breathing out, knows whether it's a shallow breath or a long breath. It gives us a picture of the breath, a clearer understanding of the place of the breath at this moment. And if you observed as you were trying to pay attention to the breath, if your mind was thinking and was moving away, going back to the past or into the future, that it was difficult to get a clear picture of the breath. There may have been moments when you were aware of the feeling, the touch. You were aware that this was breath in. You were aware that this was a longer breath. You might have even become aware of the space between the breaths was getting longer, time taken before the next one was coming in, the next one was going out, was taking longer. But there would have been many moments when the mind was not with the breath, but was thinking about something from the past, or thinking about something from the future, or maybe thinking about something that was happening now, a sound, or the temperature, that sort of feeling, but not paying attention to the breath. And to be able to know that the mind has wandered away from the breath and what it's paying attention to now, that is also mindfulness. The object may change, and it may not be the object that we started off with, the one that we're trying to pay attention to. But once we know, thinking, that's mindfulness re-established. Not the story that we're lost in, but knowing thinking is happening. And then with clear comprehension, we know that thinking is happening about something from the past or something from the future, that this thinking is not what I'm supposed to be paying attention to, and so we go back to the breath. These two aspects are very important, because as we develop mindfulness, we have to be aware not only of an object, but we may have a number of objects that we're paying attention to. And we may be paying attention to an object that is arising internally, that is within our own mind and body. But we also need to pay attention to objects that are happening outside ourselves. And this is where the role of clear comprehension becomes more obvious. Because what we're trying to establish is a mindfulness that doesn't just exist during our meditation period, but which grows and becomes a quality of mind, a skill that we take into our daily life. And so we're able to focus on what we're doing while we're doing it, but not just in isolation from what's going on around us, the context, and also the cause and effect relationship that is happening. When we are feeling a particular way and we say something because of the way we're feeling, we say it to someone else and we see the effect that what we said has had on them. The mindfulness is internal, first of all, to know this is how we feel, to know that we're saying something, and then to observe the reaction, the effect of what we've said, is that we're mindful externally. If we're trying to be mindful of our movements, for example, and we're walking down the busy street, we need to know the context in which we're walking so that we don't just walk out onto the middle of the road and get hit by a car. Our mindfulness has to be more expansive than just walking and paying attention to the movement in the body. So the clear comprehension at this time is where we start to make sense of the context and to see the effect of what we're saying or doing. And then as we say or do something and we recognize the effect, that effect becomes a new cause. So we say something to someone and they say something back to us. And then we notice what that produces internally, how we react to what they said, how it feels, and the feeling can be a physical feeling, like if it's an unpleasant feeling, they said something that we don't like, or it could be that they said something that we like, and there's a pleasant feeling that arises internally. And so we start to notice the cause and effect, this internal pleasant feeling or this internal unpleasant feeling is produced by having heard something, what the Buddha calls a sense contact, hearing consciousness, hearing contact, a sound heard by our ear base, hearing consciousness arises, and there is a pleasant feeling produced. This is moving from external mindfulness to internal mindfulness, and to notice that this pleasant feeling, where it's come from, the trigger has been external, but the reaction is internal. And that internal reaction becomes a new cause. First it was the effect, and now it becomes the cause. When we like it, we like that person usually. If we don't like it, we usually don't like that person. We think it's the person, but it's actually the way that we feel that we like or don't like. Now this is something to discover, and this is what I'd like to make clear about mindfulness. Mindfulness is playing a function. It has a role to play in allowing us to see more clearly what's going on in our experience, what's going on in cause and effect, going on in producing our reactions and our responses to the world around us. Now, I'd like to give you an example of how we can develop this mindfulness. And if any of you have done a meditation retreat with me, you'll know that sometimes I write down on a piece of paper particular activities that we are going to do through the day. And they're not extraordinary activities. They're the usual things that we do in the course of living. So it might be walking, or it might be reaching to turn the doorknob, or it might be lifting the cup to take a drink. It might be coughing. It might be brushing our hair. Just normal activities of daily life. But when I write them all on a piece of paper, you have to choose at random one activity to pay special attention to. And throughout the course of the day, every time you do that activity, to pay full attention to it. To be in the present moment with that activity. We come into the present moment when we focus on our body, on the activity of the body, because that is always happening in the present moment. And if we want to get a clearer picture of our experience, we need to be in the present moment, and we do that directly by focusing on the body. And it may not be just a movement, it may be an activity, so it might be washing the dishes or cleaning your teeth. And the first part of the practice is simply to remember to pay attention. And so with that one activity throughout the course of the retreat, you zero in on that. For the rest of the day, you might be completely mindless, do things without even noticing what you're doing, doing one thing while thinking about something else. But at least for that activity, you try to give it your full attention. That's the first part. And then the second part, once you've become familiar with focusing in on that activity, is to notice the mind with which you are doing that activity. Because very often we are doing something, especially if it's a routine activity, with only a part of our attention. It's something that we're so familiar with. We've done it every day of our life. And we don't have to give it our full attention to complete it, to get it right. And so while we're cleaning our teeth, we're thinking about what we've got to do in the office. While we're doing the dishes, we're thinking about how we hate doing the dishes. So the mind with which we're doing the activity is the next thing we focus on. And we become able to do that because we're in the present moment. And we're focusing on something which isn't hard to do, doesn't take our full attention. And so we can take a step back and observe the mind, the mood of the mind as we do this thing. It gives us the context in which we're doing the activity. This is very important because very often we don't realize that it's not the activity itself that we don't like, or it's not the activity that's giving us a hard time. The activity itself can be quite innocuous, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but not that terrible. But the attitude with which we're doing it, or the mood we were in before we started that activity, is making it more of a chore than it needs to be. This is where we start to get a better picture of what our experience is made up of. Just as we often blame the other person for making us feel terrible. Once we start to notice what's going on, we see that very often we brought that terrible feeling with us even before we met the person. We met them with that terrible feeling. Or the thing that they said that's produced an unpleasant feeling in us, the unpleasant feeling is coming from us because it was in us. It was there as a potential. But knowing that it's come doesn't mean that we have to now act on it if we see clearly cause and effect. This is how the mindfulness, paying attention to what's going on while it's going on, not just the activity, but focusing on the activity, helps us to be in the present moment, to be awake, and to see more clearly what's happening. What's happening internally, what's happening externally. Now, if you're on a retreat and if you were on a retreat recently with me, you'll know that I gave people a particular exercise to do to show how infrequent it is that we're actually in the present moment with the activity that we're doing, and how infrequent it is in our actual experience that we're even aware of the mind with which we're doing that activity, the context of our experience. This particular exercise is called the Three Bites practice. And on a retreat where we're observing noble silence and we don't speak unnecessarily, we take our meals in silence. All we have to do is pay attention to eating. But the experience is that while we're eating, even though we don't speak to anyone, our mind is full of busyness, thinking about things that aren't to do with the present moment, aren't to do with the food in front of us, aren't to do with the retreat that we're on. Our mind just runs away as soon as it gets an opportunity. And because we eat so often, we're used to eating, we don't have to pay that much attention, and we don't even have to talk. We can really just go wherever we like mentally during the time that we're eating, and we're supposed to be paying attention to eating. So in the three-bite practice, we're encouraged that with the first mouthful of food, that we remember our teachers. And out of appreciation for the fact that we have this opportunity to practice, because first of all the Buddha became enlightened and gave us this wonderful teaching, and then so many teachers have, since the time of the Buddha, passed on this wonderful Dharma. When we take the first mouthful of food, we remember all those teachers with devotion, and we mentally share the food with them, wishing them all well. With the second bite of food, the second mouthful, we remember anyone who's helped us in our life, maybe just one person or a group of people who've helped us, and we remember what they've done, and we express our gratitude to them and we wish them well. And then with the third bite of food, we remember that even though we are fortunate enough to have food on our plate, that there are many people in the world at this very moment who don't have a meal today. And so we remember all of those people and we wish that they may have the nourishment that they need out of kindness and compassion. So this practice is ostensibly so that we can generate a feeling of devotion and gratitude to our teachers, a feeling of gratitude to those who've helped us, and a feeling of kindness and compassion to those who don't have food to eat. But what this practice really shows us, that no matter how determined we are that we're going to take the first mouthful remembering our teachers, it's very difficult to do that. Because even if we've determined that's what we're going to do before we sit down, by the time we sit down, our mind has gone somewhere else. And we've taken the first mouthful, as we very often take the first mouthful of our food, paying attention maybe to how it smells, how it looks, how it tastes. But after that first mouthful, the mind has gone off. And we've finished very often halfway through the meal and we've forgotten that we're eating, and we think, who ate this food? Who ate my meal? Oh, must have been me. Didn't taste it. Or maybe we thought, not thinking about the food we're eating now, this reminds me of such and such. Or we may not even be thinking about the meal at all. Our mind has gone off onto a completely different subject. Now, it's only by making a practice of the three first mouthfuls of food that we actually notice how very difficult it is to pay attention to what we're doing while we're doing it, let alone to be able to deliberately cultivate these wholesome states of mind like gratitude. We hear about how good this will be for us. We hear how these wholesome states of mind bring energy and happiness into the mind. We think it's a really good idea. We're going to do it. But when we actually sit down to try to do it, even when it's such a specific situation, we discover that our mind just runs away. And we might be able to do it for the first mouthful, but by the second mouthful, we've lost it. Halfway through the meal, we remember, oh, that's right, I'm supposed to remember everyone I'm grateful to. Right? So I'll remember them now. Yes, halfway through the meal. And then the next group to remember those who don't have any food. We finish the meal and then that's right, those people who don't have it. That's right, I'll think of them now. And I encourage you to try this. It's a very simple practice, but it's very illuminating because you will find just how difficult it is. Now, this isn't to indicate how hard-hearted you are and how difficult it is for you to bring wholesome states of mind into your mind deliberately, but to show how difficult it is and how rare it is to be mindful and to be paying attention not only to what we're doing but to the mood of the mind. So once we realize I was supposed to pay attention and I didn't, we might then notice, wow, look, I was worrying about what I've got to do this afternoon, or I was remembering that thing that I did yesterday, or I might be even in next year. Fancy that. But what we're seeing is what is always happening with the mind. Not just when we sit down to eat, but when we go throughout the course of our day, this is what's happening. This is why it's so difficult to become mindful of what we're doing while we're doing it, to become mindful of the mood of the mind, and why in meditation it's so difficult to become mindful of the meditation object and to stay focusing on it moment after moment, and then to be able to see the mood of the mind that we're bringing to the meditation. Because we're not doing it most of the moments of our day. And so when we sit down to meditate, how can we expect that the mind is going to be satisfied with just staying on one object? That it's going to be able to maintain that focus moment after moment if in its ordinary everyday life it's just moving constantly away to something more exciting, more interesting. So first thing is I'd encourage you to do that practice, to just to get a glimpse of the task that we have in front of us. So when we are trying to become more mindful, then we not only try during our meditation, we find time and activities, moments during the course of the day to focus on, to really help ourselves develop this strength of mind to stay in the present moment with one object moment after moment. And it's only when we are able to do that that the mind starts to become calmer, clearer. There starts to be some space in the mind instead of one thing on top of the other so that we can't see clearly. We can't see cause and effect as it's arising. We can't see how what we say produces an effect in someone else and what they say back to us is the next effect which produces a result, a cause. It's a cause for us that produces a result. We can't see that We can't experience it directly until the mind is quiet enough, until there's enough space in the mind to see things as they're arising. Otherwise, the mind is just so murky, so busy, so clouded, that these individual interactions just pass by so quickly that we can't hope to grasp them, to see them clearly. So for mindfulness to start to develop, it doesn't mean that there's no thinking. We don't come to a point where there's absolutely no thought. We don't come to a point where there's absolutely nothing happening. Sounds arising, sights to be seen. There is this external awareness, this external mindfulness, but there's a much broader mindfulness that includes these things without being overwhelmed by them. And to get to that stage where there's this broad awareness, this broad mindfulness, which can move from the internal to the external, we need to keep training the mind in coming back to the present moment and being clearly focused on what's happening right now. By being able to take up the meditation object, gradually the mind sticks to the meditation object and things come into the orbit of our awareness. But we don't chase after them any longer. We don't pursue them. We don't get caught up in them. We simply allow them to go, to arise, and to cease. Because if we start to become more mindful, our experience of things coming and going becomes much clearer. We recognize that the mind is always entertaining new contexts, always entertaining new thoughts, always entertaining new emotions, and we don't have to get caught up in them as they pass through the mind. We don't have to make them so important that we chase after them. We just allow them to come and go. And as we're able to maintain the focus in the present moment, and particularly the focus on our own mind and body, it becomes easier, it becomes a feeling of having a stability in the mind, which is actually a pleasant feeling, a feeling of stability that becomes like a platform in the mind from which we can go out to engage with the world, but we don't have to be drawn out unnecessarily. And from that platform or that refuge, we engage with the world in a much more skillful way. And it's only when we've started to clear some space in the mind that we can then start to cultivate the second of the factors of enlightenment, which is the investigation of Dharma. Because until we clear some space in the mind, we live our life and we experience everything from our personal point of view. Everything is happening with me at the center stage. And everything that we are experiencing, we interpret in terms of our old reactions. Our conditioning blinds us to what's happening right now that may be any different from what's ever happened before. So you can notice this when you do activities which you do routinely every day. How to tell the difference between how it felt cleaning the teeth this morning to how it felt cleaning the teeth this evening? We just tune out. We've cleaned the teeth so many times that we don't know if there's any difference. We're not actually aware if there's any difference. We might have cleaned the teeth this morning quite relaxed and quite refreshed. We might have had a hard day at work, and so when we cleaned our teeth this evening, we were really putting far more effort into cleaning them than needed. But we were doing that because we were agitated because of what the day's work was like. And we're doing it to our teeth without even noticing, because we do it, do our teeth just with no attention on what we're doing. Now, if we want to learn anything about the way that we clean our teeth, we have to pay attention. And so one of Achyam Brahm's practices, which he gives to people, is instead of starting to clean your teeth the usual way, you do it back to front. If you usually start on the right, you start on the left. If you usually start on the top, you start on the bottom. Well, how can you do it back to front unless you pay attention to what you usually do? Only then do you have something to compare it with. So it requires that you pay attention. So if we want to investigate Dharma, if we want to start to contemplate the Buddha's teachings and then see whether it's true in our own experience, we have to not only know the teaching, but we have to know our experience, and we have to be paying close enough attention to be able to see, not just from our personal perspective, but to start to see in a more detached way, a more impersonal way, more objectively. So tonight I'd like to give you an example of a teaching that the Buddha gave about these pleasant and unpleasant feelings that come into our experience. And in one particular teaching, which is quite well known, called the teaching on the two darts, or arrows, the Buddha said that the untrained ordinary person, when they experience an unpleasant feeling in the body, not only feels an unpleasant feeling, but resists that feeling, resents it, gets upset by that feeling. And so they not only experience one arrow, the bodily feeling, but they also feel a second arrow, the mental feeling of distress at having an unpleasant bodily feeling. The trained disciple who has started to understand the nature of reality understands that having a body such as ours, unpleasant feelings are bound to arise. Just sitting here for some period of time without moving, unpleasant feeling arises in the body, not to mention when there's sickness or accident. Unpleasant feeling comes, unpleasant feeling goes. It may not go away altogether, but it will certainly change over time. So the trained noble disciple, understanding that, accepts that unpleasant feeling without getting upset about it, without resisting it, without trying to get away from it. Now, that's the first part of the teaching. So you can notice next time you have an unpleasant feeling in the body, if there's a mental reaction of, I don't like this, that goes along with it. Now, you can only notice that if you have paid attention to the physical feeling, and if you then are able to notice the feeling in the mind. Because what happens usually if an unpleasant feeling comes when we're sitting, we just move. And we don't even know that we've moved, because we may be listening to the talk or we may be talking to someone else, but there's one part of the mind which is always looking out for how this body feels. And we might move without even knowing consciously that's what we've done. So how do we know why we're moving? And how do we know if not only was there this physical unpleasant feeling, but the mental reaction to it of pushing it away? Only if we're mindful and paying attention. An understanding, oh, that's an unpleasant feeling in the body. It's arisen because I'm sitting for so long. It's only natural. Ah, there's a resistance in the mind to that. I don't like that. I don't want that to be like that. I'm going to move. Then we notice there is this reaction in the mind. So, what the Buddha said is true in my experience. Only then it becomes true for us. But that's not where the teaching finishes. In this particular teaching, the Buddha said that the unpleasant feeling that arises in both the trained disciple and the untrained, the wise disciple and the unwise. The wise disciple just accepts it. But the unwise disciple, who doesn't accept it and who rejects it, resists it, gets upset by it. Because of that resistance, they reinforce the underlying tendency in the mind to reject and resist the things that they don't like. That we have this potential in the mind towards ill will, aversion. And we all have it. It's a potential that we all have. But when we don't know what we're doing, we mindlessly, carelessly, unknowingly keep on reinforcing that tendency, because when we have something that is unpleasant, we resist it. We don't accept it. We don't allow it to be there. We don't realize that it's temporary, that it will change. We may see, if we are wise, it's come about through these causes. When the causes change, the effect will change. So it's come about by sitting for a long time in this position. It's only natural. I can change my position without rejecting that feeling, without making it a problem, simply just doing what needs to be done. Thereby, I don't reinforce the underlying tendency to resistance, to aversion, which will just surface again and again and again because we are feeding it. But the Buddha goes further. In this particular teaching, he says, not only is the underlying tendency to resistance and rejection reinforced when we have this mental rejection of this natural unpleasant feeling, but because the untrained person doesn't know any other way to find happiness and pleasure, that very often to get rid of that unpleasant feeling, they chase after sensual pleasure. And thereby, they increase the underlying tendency towards greed, towards craving, towards desire in the mind. To replace that unpleasant feeling, because the untrained person doesn't understand it, isn't able to abide with it, doesn't clearly comprehend its nature, and doesn't know any way to get rid of it, they chase after pleasant feeling. Now, a very good example of that in modern life is shopping therapy, retail therapy. We've all heard of that. We feel miserable, so we go out to the mall just to hang around or just to browse or just to see what's there. Why are we doing that? Why are we going there? And for sure, once we're there and we expose the mind to all of the temptations, well, it's pretty likely that we'll find something that we need, something that will help us, something that will make us feel better. And this is just an example, but there are many ways in which we cope with the unpleasant, unwanted things in our life, not by dealing with it, but by looking for some pleasant experience to replace it with. And as the Buddha said, this just reinforces the desire in the mind. And this desire, we know, has no bottom to it. It's a bottomless pit, can never be satisfied. We can never come to the end of desire by feeding it. We can only come to the end of desire by not wanting anything else. And so because we don't realize this process and we don't understand it and we don't see it in our own experience, we have no opportunity to wake up. Wake up to what we're doing to ourselves. Wake up to the way that we can start to change our behavior for our own good. Now, this is why mindfulness with clear comprehension is so important, because we can't hope to see these things for ourselves unless we can pay attention to what's going on in our own experience moment by moment. And we may be a long way from being able to be mindful every moment of the day, but if we have episodes in our day when we pay attention and we see clearly what's going on, that it's true, I'm reaching for this cup of coffee, not because I need a cup of coffee, but because I feel miserable, or because I'm fed up, or because I think I should get a reward. And I'm just mentioning cup of coffee because I know that's my one. So you might have others. That's something that is allowable for nuns. So shopping therapy is not one of them, not one of the options. They're so available, so I'm just using that one. And I know from experience what the Buddha said is true. I know that because I'm able to be mindful. Not 100% of the time, but often enough, and in situations that I'm aware are the ones that are very fraught with danger, I've seen that pattern for myself. And I know what the Buddha said is true because I've seen it for myself. Now, you can only know it's true if you see it for yourself. And you can only see to that extent if you start to develop mindfulness and clear comprehension with the simple things, the uncomplicated things of your life, and you start building up that skill, which it is, again and again and again, in your daily life and also in meditation. Now, meditation is a wonderful opportunity to observe the Buddha's teaching, because we don't have to interact with anyone else. But we notice how hard it is just to stay within our own space. When someone coughs, we go out and have a conversation with them about their coughing. We think it's their coughing that's causing us to be disturbed, but actually it's in our own mind. The sound has taken place. It's produced hearing consciousness because we're paying attention. And through that, a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling has arisen. And to get rid of that unpleasant feeling, instead of just being aware of it and allowing it to pass, we have to do something with it. We have to go out and tell them off, or think about how we can avoid that kind of disturbance next time. Any of those things that arise in our mind. And when we're practicing meditation, that's the perfect opportunity to see how we're always engaging with the world, even when it's not necessary. We're putting ourselves out there and we're being drawn out there time and time again. We're being drawn out there because we are allowing ourselves to be triggered in that way and not knowing the process that arises, the experience that's produced. We just follow our habit patterns. So the other aspect of developing this mindfulness with clear comprehension is not only to investigate the Buddha's teaching, but to start to refrain from acting in ways which reinforce our suffering, and to develop the strength of mind and the stability of mind to hold our own seat, to stay on what's useful for us. So if we can notice the unpleasant feeling that's produced and observe it as it arises, stays for a while and passes away within our own body, and the reaction in the mind that arises, stays for a while and passes away, we can be at peace. We don't have to go out to anything. We just simply stay watching, stay still as that experience arises and passes away. We don't add anything onto it. We don't produce another experience like it for the future. And then in this sequence of the seven factors of enlightenment, as we keep doing this, we develop energy instead of wasting our energy through the day by constantly being busy, mentally busy even when we don't have to be. We start to conserve our energy. We are able to apply that energy to what we want to apply it to, rather than just losing it constantly through the mind running riot. And then in this sequence, we start to experience the relief of a still mind. The relief of a still mind and a happy mind. The relief of a still mind and a peaceful mind. Because the more the mind is able to rest and recover its energy, the more it's able to dwell in stillness, the more that pleasant feeling, which we may have touched on in the meditation tonight, the more that arises from within the mind itself. And that becomes like a buffer that we experience as a cushioning effect on the interactions that we have moment by moment with the world. The spaciousness in the mind grows, the cushioning in the mind grows, and so although we are engaging with the world as we need to, we're not engaging in the same sort of frantic way, in the same habitual way. We've got more time to stop and recollect what we're doing and what's appropriate in this situation and what is helpful and skillful as a reaction to this particular situation. And so the mind learns to be at ease, or gets the opportunity to be at ease with self moment after moment. And then when we sit down to meditate, we find that the mind that's been at ease during the day comes to the meditation with that ease. And the meditation starts to develop, to become pleasant, to become enjoyable. A feeling of happiness and joy can arise. And gradually this becomes more sustainable. We take it with us from our meditation and we engage in the world feeling much brighter, much more able to cope. That's the effect of the mind starting to develop in this way. And then when we come back to the meditation, we're able to find some tranquility, some deeper peace in the mind. And this again comes out in our daily life, in our interactions with people. There's much more of a sense of well-being which we bring to the situations that we face moment by moment. And as this continues to develop, this is supported by the mindfulness, the clear comprehension, the investigation of our experience in the light of the Buddha's teaching. And as we see again and again the truth of the Buddha's teaching and how we can start to pull ourselves out of this unknowing, this ignorance that has been causing us so much suffering, more happiness, more joy, more confidence arises in the mind. And gradually, as we continue to develop, we can experience ever greater states of happiness within the mind itself. And as we continue to develop not only this happy mind, but the wisdom that it allows to arise, eventually we develop such a stable and strong mind that we can remain equanimous through even challenging situations. An unpleasant situation, we don't resist and resent it. When we get into a situation that we don't like, we have some inner peace, some inner stability, some inner security that we can fall back on. We don't have to go out and find something nice to eat or nice to do or nice to hear or nice to buy or whatever to make us feel okay. We've got that resource internally. And as we continue to practice and our understanding gets ever deeper, our peace gets ever deeper, and this is the path to enlightenment. We're all already on the path, but we're starting to really get the fruits long before we've reached the final stage. Now, this all starts with becoming mindful in the present moment of what we're doing while we're doing it, and what's happening in the mind, what kind of mind we have that we're doing this work with. And so I remind you again, the three-bite practice. It's a wonderful opportunity to show us just how mindless we actually are. And then as we take it up sincerely and we persevere with it, we not only get the opportunity to experience what it's like to stay in the present moment and to appreciate the food that we've got in front of us, but we also get the opportunity to develop gratitude and loving kindness. So from a very simple beginning, this practice that we build on, which is integral to our growth and development, takes us all the way to enlightenment. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, yes. Is there no such thing as a bad feeling? What do you mean by a bad feeling?
Yeah, because often I feel that if I feel a certain way, it's not good.
Shouldn't have to feel that way. I'm afraid I don't quite understand a bad feeling. The Buddha gave many more descriptions of the kind of feelings that arise in our experience than just pleasant, unpleasant and neutral. And there are feelings of pleasure which are born out of sensual gratification, and there are feelings of pleasure that are born out of spiritual practice. There are unpleasant feelings that come from having someone say something terrible to us. And then there's the unpleasant feeling which comes when we stretch ourselves to perhaps refrain from saying something that we know will hurt someone. And that can produce, as we resist the temptation or the urge to say that, that can produce or be experienced as an unpleasant feeling. But following that, if we are mindful, we'll notice a sense of satisfaction that we were able to take control of our mind at that time, and a pleasant feeling can then arise. So there are feelings which are not pleasant, but which can actually protect us from doing something which is unskillful. Is that the sort of, I don't know where. Yes. So So feeling, eventually when there is sufficient stability in the mind and buoyancy in the mind and clarity in the mind, even the most unpleasant feeling is just a feeling. And that's where one has the equanimity to abide with unpleasant feelings. And they are just unpleasant. But that doesn't make them bad. Yeah. So that, and again, it's like with the breath. It's not that we're trying to do anything with the breath. It's doing something with the mind. And it's not that we're trying to do something with the feeling. We're trying to do something with the mind. So when the mind is trained, an unpleasant feeling is simply an unpleasant feeling. And the bad, or it shouldn't be, or I don't like it, is what we add on to it. Yes. Well, it's a very complex and deep question. Basically, how much willpower should we put into fighting our addictions and taking a stand against them, or just cultivating the mind in meditation or doing all the good things in Dharma? Is that basically what you... Right, okay. So the thing is, we need to do both, because to get to the point where there is no ignorance about our self or self-view takes a very long time, and we can't wait until we reach that point. The person asking the question has mentioned Acharya Brahm's simile of whatever you have a hand, it will pick up things, so what we've got to really do is cut off the hand. And that's the view of the wrong view of self makes us go out into the world. We chase after these things because we wrongly understand where our happiness is to be found. So the Buddha's path is to do both things, to actively work to cultivate the wholesome and the good. And that is why in the practice I mentioned, the three-bite practice, if we can give our full attention just to eating, then we're cultivating mindfulness. If we give our attention to developing gratitude for the food that we've got or to the people that we've have helped us, that's cultivating a wholesome mind state at that moment. And because the mind can only entertain one thing at a time, while that wholesome mind state is present, there's no room for the unwholesome to enter. And also, we're not cultivating or feeding the underlying tendency to either aversion or to lust or greed. So just in the cultivation of that wholesomeness, we're doing something that's beneficial. And if we could do that continuously all the time, then eventually we wear out all those addictions. But the reality is that we don't do that all the time, and our addictions surface. So on one hand, we can deal with addictions by developing the positive states of mind. But on the other hand, we also need to develop wisdom to understand the addiction itself. And so that's why I've given the teaching tonight, which is a wisdom teaching about noticing how we pursue pleasure because of an unpleasant feeling that's present, not necessarily because we think that thing that we're pursuing is really worth going for, but it's an attempt to get rid of what we don't like. And so if we're tackling an addiction or even just a strong habit pattern, which we may not like to think of as an addiction, we can start to notice, when is it that I reach out for that? In what circumstances do I feel most vulnerable to not being able to say no to that thing? And we start to identify for ourselves the cause and effect relationship. And then we can start to see, how can I challenge that earlier on in the process, not waiting until I'm absolutely so fed up there's no other alternative but to go and get that thing which has always given me pleasure. So with wisdom, we start to tackle it not just at the point where we're expressing the addiction, but further before that. And in terms of the underlying tendencies, the underlying tendencies are potentials in the mind which are triggered by context or what we experience in our day-to-day life. So there is a point at which those things which are triggered can simply be known without acting on them. And then there's the point at which, once they've been triggered, they overwhelm the mind and we act on them. So in working to counter addiction, yes, willpower can help us, and we can at that time just not act on it, but willpower will not overcome the addiction. Willpower alone will not be enough. There has to be the understanding of the process and also the buoyancy of the mind which comes from doing what is wholesome. All of those things together will help us to challenge the addiction. So it's not one thing or the other, it's all of the things together.
Arahant Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Bhūtān Bhagavatam Abhivādayāmi Svakkhato Bhagavatā Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi